on Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube. This is an interactive mass chat. It's why it works so well. So whichever channel you are on, if you have any thoughts, post it as a reply. Use the hashtag MassChatLive, and we will try our best to address your question when appropriate. So yeah, today is one of my most exciting areas in mass teaching, as the use of manipulatives and multiple representations. So got a lovely panel here. We'll just go have a quick round of introductions. I'll start. Atul, I'm a online maths and science tutor based in London. Let's go with you, Christine, first.
Thanks. Right, well, I'm Christine. I'm also a tutor. I have been doing online, but I'm looking forward to actually getting back to face-to-face teaching in a couple of weeks now. But I work mostly with children with dyslexia or dyscalculia.
Great. Limes?
Hello, I'm Limes Wright. I currently teach maths GCSE research students, so very anxious students, and I have a specialist interest in maths anxiety and working memory.
Great. Rhiannon?
Hi, I'm Rhiannon Rainbow. I'm the School Improvement Lead Maths for the Greenshaw Learning Trust. I'm interested in this stuff for my own CPE, but also because I oversaw the online lessons that were being produced across our trust for maths last year. So I'm looking at how we can make that sort of 10% better for the next round, should we be continuing to develop that also.
Love the 10% better phrase. Thanks. And Suzanne?
Hi, my name's Suzanne. I'm a acting second department and maths teacher for Key Stage 3 and Key Stage 4 in the Multi-Academy Trust. I'm also responsible for kind of improving numeracy across the school and the curriculum. And I'm joined this because I tried to watch one of Pete's videos using manipulatives for quadratic sequences and got so lost 2 minutes in. So I'm hoping this will help.
You've got him live this time, so.
Yes.
Mr. Taylor.
Hi, I'm Josh Taylor. I'm currently 4 years into teaching, work at secondary in East Manchester. And over the last year, I've sort of been really thinking about how to use manipulatives and representations. So I'm looking forward to this.
Brendan, thanks.
Hi, I'm Brendan Keegan, based in Leicester, head of maths at a school in Leicester. This is my first year as head of maths and numeracy lead for the school. I've used manipulatives before, but I've arrived in a school that has never used manipulatives and doesn't have any either at the moment. So I'm looking to get that started in my current school and just looking to start using them to improve attainment across the board.
Thanks, and finally on to you, Pete.
Yeah, hi, so I'm Pete. Until very recently, I was a head of maths in 1116 school just outside of Leicester, actually, Brendan. We'll have to talk later on. And then very recently have made the step up to assistant head teacher. I also work for the East Midlands South Maths Hub as the secondary teaching for mastery lead. And of course, I wrote the book, Visible Maths. There we are. How many seconds was that before the first plug? It is, Lives. Yeah, thank you very much.
Yeah.
Excellent. Yes, I wrote the book, Visible Maths, which is all about use of manipulative and representation to support structure. And also, of course, host the YouTube channel that Suzanne talked about, in which I try and exemplify how manipulatives can be used to explore concepts, processes, procedures in mathematics.
Fantastic. And Visible Maths is exactly the vision I had when I started these live streams, because this is the video medium. It's visual, and thanks to technology, which we'll get onto later, you can even have manipulatives online and have them interactive both ways. So brilliant. We'll kick off with a few questions our panelists had for you, Pete. I don't know if you have them on a list, or would you like me to say them?
Fine. So I'll pick them up literally as they came in. So we started with Dave, Mr. Taylor Mass, and when to first introduce manipulatives, which for me is always an interesting question, because they're how kids start to learn maths.
Mm.
You know, when kids are first learning maths, they learn right in the early years, and Christine and Ree will have both seen this because they're early years trained and experienced. to a greater or lesser extent. And, you know, it's how kids first start to work with mathematical ideas. It's how kids first start to make sense of maths, you know, actually moving objects, working with objects, filling buckets, playing with things. And so for me, the question shouldn't be, when do we start introducing manipulatives? It's more, why do they go away? Why do we stop using them at certain points? Through, you know, when do we suddenly get to the point where we say, well, we're not going to bother with these anymore? And of course, you know, one of the big things with manipulatives is that, and for me, that, you know, this is the big thing, is that they, we use them to support kids understanding mathematical structure and to make sure kids can recognize when structures are reappearing and when this bit of math that I'm looking at now is the same as or similar to this bit of math that I've looked at before. And where do these, where are these ideas reoccurring? And so if I'm used to working with manipulatives in this bit and looking at an idea using manipulatives here, then eventually I want to get to a point where I understand the structure enough without having to need to use the manipulative to carry out the actual, you know, the manipulation. I can use, do the manipulation visually, or I can do the manipulation in the abstract, I can do the manipulation in my head. But then when I come to look at that idea in a different context, well, then it would make perfect sense to come back to the manipulative and say, right, well, we're used to this idea, but now we're using it in this way, or we're looking at it through this lens or whatever else. But let's go back to the way we made sense of it before and say, right, well, what does that mean now? And how, what does that mean now we're adapting this? So, you know, simple example would be something like we're used to what addition looks like when it comes to positive numbers. So then we want to talk about what addition looks like when it comes to negative numbers. Well, then let's go back to what we knew about positive numbers and how and how the structure worked there and how the manipulatives gave an insight into that structure. And then see how that can be adapted and how that works now that we're considering some of these numbers to be negative. And then again, eventually want to get to the point where I can do that manipulation mentally, visually, abstract, written down. But for me, the big thing about, you know, introducing manipulatives is ideally they should never go away. They should always be there. They should always be available. We should always be looking to bring them back in to support sense making when we're dealing with an old idea in a new way, or when we're looking at combining two concepts of which we have previous understanding of, and that they should be part of a student's experience of maths all the way through, from early years right the way up to, you know, post 16 mathematics, as Limes would be looking at and others would be looking at. They should be part of that journey all the way through, because they are how kids start to make sense of mathematics and mathematical structure. I don't know, David, if that completely answers your question or if there was any follow-up. Mr. Taylor?
Yeah, I guess maybe changing the question to reintroducing manipulatives. You mentioned negatives. I think negatives is the first that I did it with my classes, bringing in two-sided counters and talking about zero pairs. And then later when we came to using some algebra tiles, that was really helpful. Yes, those ones at all. Yeah, so just where do you start with your two-sided counters and what does that look like? And then do you maybe go into other areas, you know, with your algebra tiles with their negatives and positives and see if you can relate them? Or, yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, in terms of reintroduction, it's, for me, it's whenever we are looking at linking two concepts, and that's where we tend to find most procedures and procedural teaching actually occurs. Like, you know, we have a procedure for adding fractions, say, or procedure for adding negatives. Well, why do we have a procedure for adding fractions or adding negatives? It's because what's happening here is we're trying to take this concept that is addition, and we're trying to take this concept which is the idea of a negative number, and we're trying to see how they work together. So what that comes down to is, okay, well, I can give you a procedure to handle that. And I could teach that procedure in a very sort of rule-based way. Or I could say, right, well, let's look at what we know about negative. And this would come to, you know, introducing negatives. And like you say, we can introduce negative numbers in various different ways, using number lines, using the idea of rotation and flipping. counters over and things like that. But what if we're going to use manipulatives in that way to make sense of this, then what we need is good models, good structures for those two separate concepts. Yeah, what does it mean to add? What does it look like to add? How do I see addition? How do I make sense of addition? And then what do negatives look like? How do negatives relate to positives? What is our model for number at this point? And then, okay, so I know what addition looks like. I know what negative numbers look like and how negative numbers are related to positive numbers. And I have good models for these things. When they then come together, well, it's kind of just like, well, yeah, now this links with that. And almost there should be very little in the way of surprise by that point. You know, there should be very little in the way of, well, why does that work like that? Because it should be an almost natural consequence of, well, this works like this and this works like this, and all I'm doing now is bringing the two together. And when you have that, and when you develop a curriculum that works in that way, where we have secure introduction to an understanding of these separate concepts, we try and use them together, then these things tend to flow quite naturally. And so, yeah, you know, for me, it's about reintroducing every time we're going to look at either a new concept or the way two or more concepts are coming together to play together, and using our pre-existing understanding of those concepts to sort of try and make sense of how they work together. Suzanne?
Suzanne, yeah.
Are you kind of saying, so the manipulatives are kind of acting like a bridge between that concrete fundamental understanding of how numbers work and the abstract new concept we're introducing? Or is that kind of a way of looking at it?
Sorry, I've just realised, I've just seen it's Josh, isn't it? Not David. I don't know why I had David in my spine there, Josh. No worries. So what I'm saying is that, yeah, these things are fundamentally abstract in nature.
Yeah.
Yeah. Numbers are abstract things. They exist in thought. You know, they are things that we think of. Addition is an abstract idea. It has concrete roots, you know, and it sort of came about through wanting to sort of abstract a notion that arose from concrete things in terms of, you know, collecting money or collecting things or whatever else. But fundamentally, these things are abstract in nature. So when we work with these things, when we're trying to make sense of these things, the only way we can really make sense of them is using models and is using sort of good ways of thinking about them. And this is not unique to maths either. You know, this, the same thing happens in physics and in the sciences and stuff like that. You know, the classic one I always come back to is the model of the atom and how that's evolved over time from the initial sort of pudding, you know, current pudding idea, which we all meet at school at various points, where you have a ball that is the sort of nucleus, and that was studied with electrons, to the sort of Bohr model of the atom, where you've got the nucleus at the center and the electrons orbiting, to then further sort of abstraction of that, where you're looking at energy shells or you're looking at probability distributions for where the electrons are, and that's taking, you know, quite advanced physics at that point. But what we're putting in place here is good ways of thinking about it, from which we can make sense of properties, from which we can make sense of structure. Mm. And when we've got these sort of abstract ideas, that's the only way we can really get a sense of what's going on and what's happening. So these concrete manipulatives ultimately are a vehicle by which we can communicate that model, communicate that way of thinking, or pupils can manipulate those things to sort of get a sense of how this works and how this model works. And that's, for me, where it's the a bridge is a nice term for it, I guess. Yes, in that we're taking this thing that we know to be abstract, and we are supporting students in seeing good ways of thinking about it, good ways of making sense about it. And the manipulative serves as the model by which they can sort of work with that and make their sense of this abstract idea.
Hmm. Can I ask something?
Yeah, I was going to chip in with the same thing in physics. As mathematicians, as expert mathematicians, I would say we tend to, you know, there was this great retweet about Anne Watson. You have to be simultaneously an expert and think like a novice at the same time when you're teaching mathematics. And just going back to the world of physics as well, Pete, the most sticky ideas, the most memorable ideas tend to be, because we live in a concrete world, they're based around concrete ideas. And Newton, for example, his story about the apple falling down is a thing we all relate to. Like, at some point he did see the apple fall down. It's a real concrete thing. And then he came up with he thought about the laws of gravity. Then he thought about, he did a lot of work on mechanics. He didn't come up with calculus just like that. He did quite a lot of real world stuff. And then he abstracted it out to calculus. And now we've gone to the stage where gravitational fields, and that we're looking at gravitational waves, and gravity isn't even what force is all about, space-time continuum. But initially it comes down to like living in that concrete thing, thinking about those attraction between the objects, real things, because that's the world we experience. So you all have to come back to that.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, often, you know, many mathematical ideas arise from that. So we see something in the real world, we want to be able to think about it, and we want to be able to see where that thinking takes us. And that, for me, is the beautiful thing about maths, is that we can start with something and we can just think and see where that thinking takes us. So, you know, again, taking the idea of addition probably came about from the idea of collecting, you know, of I want to represent this process of collection. You know, I have different animals. How many animals do I have in total, or coins? How much money do I have in total, or whatever? But then we can think about it, and we can take that thought process so far beyond that initial context from which the idea may have initially arisen, and we can start to think about, okay, well, now we've got negative numbers that came in obviously much later into the body of mathematics. We can think about how addition works with negatives. We can think about how addition works with fractions. We can think about how addition works with complex numbers. And those models that we have used, and those ways of making sense, those metaphors, will still stand us in good stead. And when we're thinking about, you know, addition with complex numbers, we can't be contradicting things that we already know about addition, because that's part of the structure that already exists. So that's, for me, the real power and beauty of mathematics, is that it allows us to start with something that might, you know, we might notice or might arise from us wanting to explain or symbolically represent what is happening in a real world situation. But then we can keep thinking, and we can keep thinking, and we can think beyond the situation from which something first arose. Christine, you were going to bring something in, were you?
Limes.
Oh, is it lime? Sorry.
Is that okay? Yeah, sorry. Thank you. My students, by the time they get to me, obviously, you know, they're post-16, they're anxious. If they've not come across manipulatives before, or different just representations, they are, you know, their barriers are up already. So, and of course, by the time they're age 16, 17, they've experienced a lot of life, if you like. And so, talking about negative numbers, I tried to introduce thinking about zero pairs, and about there was a task based on Dom Stewart about if you add a larger negative number to a positive number, you know, what is your answer going to be? Is it negative? And I tried it out on them, and it was just complete. I tried it with three different classes, and I just thought, this isn't getting me anywhere because it was so abstract. So in the end, I thought about, right, what can I pin this abstract concept to something they could understand? Because even a number line, they just couldn't understand it. So in the end, I just said, right, at zero is your house. You're looking at it side on. So if you want to add four, you're actually going out your front door. So I was basically getting them a bit of embodied cognition, if you like, getting them to think, right, I'm walking out of my house. If I walk out the front, it's actually going, because it's side on, you know, you're going right on the number line. And so if you want to say go, you know, you want to have a negative eight, something like that, you're going towards the back garden. And so you're thinking about, right, how far into the back garden am I? So talking about, right, how many steps do you have to go back to get back to the front of the house, to get back to the house? So if you were four steps in front of the house, you're four four steps back, and then, well, we want another negative four, so you need to go another four steps into the back garden. So I had to pin it to that, and that seems to be working. But so the representations, obviously, I really want to learn as much as I can, because my students are anxious, they need something to pin their understanding to. But of course, not all representations will work for them, because some are just too abstract. There's, you know, trying to introduce double-sided counters now, they are not, even though I have good relationships with them, so they know I'm not going to try and put them into an awkward situation. They trust me to try and develop their understanding, but I could really see that it was just gone beyond that stage where they will take that on board, because it doesn't, they can't pin it onto anything, you know, in terms of their life experiences. So it's just things like that. But whereas bar models, in terms of ratios, they can really see that it makes sense. Exactly as you say, it's their sense making, but they've got to a stage where some things, some representations can still make sense to them, whereas others are now just too abstract. I can't really introduce that now.
Yeah, and that makes perfect sense. And actually, again, what you're talking about there, and I think, you know, Christine and Ree would be able to potentially back this up, is in fact the journey that all learners go through in terms of their introduction to maths and their introduction to number in particular. And what you've laid there, in effect, from my point of view, what you've laid there in effect is the groundwork for a vector representation. And all learners sort of go through this thing, and again, you know, I don't have an early years background, but from what I've looked at in early years, they go through this stage where they start with the object being representative of the context. So if you're talking about adding sweets, you will physically use sweets, or you will physically draw sweets. And then when you're talking about adding toys, there will be physical toys. Yeah, and the object represents the context. And the journey that you take those learners through then is through to what Mark McCourt would call the archetypal unit. So actually, because whether it's sweets or toys or whatever, we always use this many objects to represent this thing. We can represent this with an object that doesn't actually look like the object in question. So I can represent a toy or a sweet or a whatever it is with a counter or a tile, or whatever else, and that can stand for one no matter what the concept. And that's the first sort of journey into a bit of abstraction, is the move away from the context and the unit being tied to the archetypal unit. And so what you've done there is got the context tied, and you know, ideally these kids should have made that journey a very, very long time ago. And it's a real shame of their education to this point that they've not made that journey. But what you would potentially start to do now is look at that in other contexts. So like temperature would be a classic one there, and tie it to that as well, and then start to notice, and this is where those contexts would come in, start to prompt noticing and prompt awareness of the fact that whether you're moving one step out of your front door, or you're moving up by 1 degree, or you know, you're gaining 1 pound from a place of having 0 pound if you want to use money in that context, that this always looks the same and this always behaves in the same way, context independent, this behaves in the same way. And so then I can represent this and say, right, well, now let's take it out of context and let's just look at, I'm at zero and I want to add -3. What does that look like? And I might draw a vector on a number line for that, because that's all of those are sort of displacement-based models. You know, the money one, quite not so much. You might be using counters for that, but certainly, you know, the movement out of the front or back door, or the temperature are displacement-based models for addition. You know, moving forward, moving backwards, connecting on journeys. So I move this many, and then I move that many. I'm connecting the end of that journey to the previous and the next one. So for me, I would be then looking to say, right, well, let's just represent this as a vector. Let's not bother drawing the house anymore. Let's just have the zero. Let's represent it as a vector, and then let's connect the other vector and start to build the model that way. But you've taken the first step with them ultimately, and then the next step is to link the partial abstraction through the representation, through the model, to that. That would be where I would be looking at that. Suzanne wants to come in?
Just to cause problems, because why not? I was going to say, what, how much of an issue? I obviously don't teach early years at all, but I have children in year one and year three. And my son is learning at the moment addition and subtraction, bridging and exchanging. And just kind of go back to this abstract, negative numbers aren't even introduced in primary school. We tell, like, they're told the whole way through, oh, you can't do that takeaway, you can't do that subtraction, you don't have enough. And they come into secondary school and go, well, actually, this is a whole thing. All these negative numbers are real. You've been told for like 7 years of schooling, negative numbers, you can't go past zero, can't go past zero. And then we're kind of getting them in year seven and kind of saying, well, actually, no, you can. How much of an issue do you think that is? Or is it?
Yeah. So, I mean, clearly it is an issue. And ideally what we'd be looking for there is a change of language. And, you know, many people have talked about this in terms of, you know, when it's a natural question for kids to ask, isn't it? You know, seven yeah. minus five is two. What's five minus seven? It would be a fairly natural thing for kids to be asking or prompting that sort of thing. And for us to say you can't do that, I think is the wrong language. And again, you know, Mark has talked about this and others have talked about this. The language we would hope to sort of begin to introduce more at that level is the mathematics for that is something we're going to move, you're going to move on to in the future. We're not going to be looking at that now, or something like that. So to make them aware that, you know, this is part of what they're going to learn and this is part of what they're going to study. It's just not what we want to be particularly considering right at this point, but not to say we can't do, just to say we're not there yet. We're not at that point yet. We're going to come to that later on. And ideally, if we could, you know, if we could get everybody talking in that language, and not just primary teachers, secondary teachers, because we're guilty of it as well. You know, we are guilty of it as well in terms of saying, you know, roots of a quadratic and things like that. We will say that quadratic has no solutions. Well, no, actually it does. Its solutions just don't lie in the real plane. So, you know, let's, or on the real line, sorry. So let's consider that language.
You can't square root a negative
at the same point. Yeah, you can't square root a negative. Yeah, no, actually you can. And, you know, tweaking our own language around that would be equally as valuable as primary school teachers tweaking their language around can't do things. And this is where, and again, lots of people have spoken about this, you know, having that awareness of the next stages of the journey is really important for primary and the previous stages as well, for primary into secondary, early years into primary, or key stage one into key stage two, or, you know, ultimately there is just maths, and kids are going to take a journey through maths. Some will take that journey further than others, but at no point should we be undermining the future steps in that journey.
And I'll come back to that if I may. I think one of the difficulties is that primary, you don't know your next phase. Secondary, we don't know our next phase. I know a student who is in the first year of A-level that I ever taught. He's now a maths teacher, but he came back and he told me that he was sat in a maths lecture at university and he was asked, can you do this? He put his hand up in front of everybody else in that room and said, no, you can't. Because I told him at A-level, you can't do that. And he remembered that. And I've remembered that. Because at A-level, they didn't need to do that. I hadn't given them the skills to, but I had most probably said, no, you can't do that, as explicitly as that, not really thinking about the consequences of what I was saying, because I didn't know what he needed next. And then he remembers that very, very poignantly. But then I've been able to hopefully build that into my teaching a bit more. And it's absolutely been something he has built into all of his teaching. So it just, I think it happens at every stage. So university lecturers will say exactly the same about, oh, what rubbish have your A-level teachers been teaching you? Because we don't know. So you're right. We do need to be more careful. We need a bit of a sentence stem, don't we? We need a bit of a phrase that we tag on to the end to make sure that we cover that actually there's a lot more to this than what we're able to show them at the moment.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, no teacher is perfect. And if we were, then, you know, it would... Well, if we thought we were, then we'd probably be the time to leave. to be honest. So, you know, it's about recognizing those things, learning from those things. And that's why, you know, that's why it's great that people can do stuff like this and do stuff like the, you know, the PD from stuff like what the MA are doing at the minute in terms of their conference, the LaSalle conferences and things like that. This should be part of being a teacher and being a professional teacher, is constantly making yourself open to those sorts of things and reflecting on them and building them in as part of your practice.
Absolutely. I got a comment from the one and only Bernie Westacott on two-sided counters. Good point from Limes regarding older people pupils meeting double-sided counters for the first time. When we introduce this with younger pupils, we spend a good deal of time working through equivalent stage to early years pupils meeting numbers in relations to other numbers, ordering, magnitude. I completely agree with it, Limes. I mean, I do this. Just to give you like a concrete story, I've got 2T who I started with 1.5 years ago. And her mum emailed me. It was like she's had 7 other tutors. She remembered the number of tutors she's had until this point. And I was like a bit nervous, like, what am I going to do that 7 other tutors I haven't managed to do yet? But none of them had used manipulators or multiple representations. The bias towards abstract is so strong. And when we did number work, we do it right from the beginning. This is a unit, this yellow, what is one unit there? So you have 2 units. What is adding? Adding is the bringing, clumping of things together. And then what is, I use the repeated adding model for multiplication because that's better in the beginning rather than the stretching one. So we do go through all these basics, which are in the field axioms. And then negative numbers are a abstract idea. They are difficult, but teenagers can relate to them. So things like IOUs, I owe you some money. So that's like negative money. But it's definitely a journey. When you first start using it, so when I first started using counters, I didn't know what I was doing. If I'm honest, it's really messy. And my students were asking me, what the hell is this? What am I doing? What do you want me to do? It's like, and I was like, not clear what I want them to do either. So, but the more you go into it, the more you get challenged by students or by colleagues, by whoever, it just clarifies your own thinking and just stick at it and it'll start start making sense. And there's, of course, people like Bernie Westacott. There's us here. It's becoming more and more used. Pete's got the book, Mark McCourt's Teaching for Mastery. I highly recommend that for negative numbers, algebra tiles, etc.
Yeah, but that's the key thing, isn't it? You know, when we're talking about negative numbers in that way, you've taken the time to sort of go right back to what does adding look like? What do numbers look like? How do we make sense of numbers themselves? You know, what good models do we have for these abstract things that are numbers that can relate to all sorts of different contexts? You know, numbers themselves can mean so many different things in so many different places. And there's a great, I forget where it was, I saw it recently in some article about the different roles that numbers play themselves, you know, just in terms of labeling things and stuff like that. You know, the numbers appear on the back of sports players' shirts. Does that mean they're the 8th player picked? Does that mean they're the 8th player in line? No, of course it doesn't. It's just a label. It's just a symbol to represent them as being different from others and stuff like that. And so going right back to, you know, in this context of number, what are good ways of modeling them? And, you know, that will come down to discrete things in terms of counters or continuous measures, you know, length, area, things like that as ways of modeling numbers, using Cuisenaire, using Ganesh and things like that. But you have to, if they're not there with that, then trying to build the idea of adding negative numbers or what it means to be a negative number using counters is always going to be more challenging because they don't have that conception of, well, this is what numbers look like and this is what adding looks like and these are good ways of making sense of those things. And this is what I'm saying in terms of when you, in order to bring those concepts together, you have to have good conception of what they both are separately. And if you don't have that, then you're building on soggy foundations right from the beginning.
I think that's one of the things that makes me nervous about using manipulatives in my teaching, because I know I am still such a novice, even though many years ago I did primary maths early years as my specialism. That was a long time ago. and it's changed so much since then. And I'm an absolute novice right now in my understanding of manipulatives, how to use them. I know I won't be confident and fluid even in my workings of them. And whilst I'm still learning, I'm worried about if that could confuse my students and where to come in at that point. Because I was at quite a big conference recently, as in training people in becoming mastery specialists. And I was just, I didn't know quite how to take the comment that when they said to people, well, as you're learning, just go and try it out on the students, what harm can it do? And for me, I'm worried that actually me trialing these things with my students could cause more confusion, or am I just being unnecessarily cautious?
Yeah, because I mean, what harm could it do? Well, potentially quite a lot.
And that's my point. And that was the advice given to a whole room of people, well, Zoom room, you know, quite a cohort of people who were at the beginning of their maths mastery specialism training. Just go and try it out on the students. And I'm just more hesitant than that.
So I think what we have to do is take that comment in perhaps a little bit of context, which is, you know, if you've got kids that are struggling with maths and struggling to make sense of maths concepts, and for whom previous approaches to trying to teach them means that they're not really picking up these concepts and not really being able to make sense of them, then continuing in that vein and continuing in the same vein is unlikely to yield better results. You know, the old adage about doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results, and it links to insanity. So at that point, why not? Why not try something different, see if it helps, because that becomes a learning experience for you in terms of, okay, I'm seeing how this didn't help in this case, but if I tweak this and change that and did this, then it might work, might help better. And it can't make it any worse for kids than they are already at, which is, I don't get this, I don't understand this idea anyway. So from that point of view, I can see, I think, potentially the point that the guys at NCTM are trying to make there. But like you say, you know, and it's the same with any other maths concept, isn't it? When we're teaching these things, or ideally when we're trying to teach these things, we should have a big, big store of background knowledge ourselves. You know, I remember working with a young teacher who was an NQT in my department many years ago, who had no idea why zeros were significant in certain circumstances and not others. You know, she could identify significant figures, and she could teach kids to identify significant figures. You know, so this number has four significant figures in it, this number has three significant figures in it, including wherever the zeros were. But actually, why is that zero significant and that zero not? No idea, no clue. No understanding about how the roles that zero was playing or anything else. So we looked at that. She recognized that. We did some work around that. She's a better teacher because of that, and because she can provide that extra support for pupils to recognizing not just that these zeros are significant and these zeros aren't, but what is happening in the structure of the number to make those zeros significant, why zeros, and not to make those zeros significant. So I think there's an interplay there between having to spend a lot of time and do a lot of work playing, trialing with yourself and sort of making sense of these things for yourself, and, you know, experiencing part of that journey that you want students to go on. But at the same time, recognizing that if there are, you know, tried and trusted and applied things that you would have done lots of times with different pupils that do work for them, and suddenly they're not working for this group of pupils, okay, well, then there is potentially no harm in trying something different, because what we're doing at the minute is not working for them. And, you know, I agree, again, we've mentioned him a couple of times, but I agree very much with Mark on this. The fact that only one in five kids gets to the age of 16 and can only cope with less than half of a higher tier GCSE paper, I mean, that's, we should all be shocked and appalled by that, I think. And I'm no better. You know, in my school, broadly speaking, 20 to 25% of kids get 7 or better. So, and, you know, with they've not, those kids at the minute have not taken the full journey for the curriculum we're trying to put in place, and we're trying to do better things with that. But at the minute, we're no better, and I can't hold my hands up and say I'm better than that in my school either. But nationally speaking, something's not right with our maths education if that's what's happening, isn't it? So why whole scale and wide scale, we should be open to trying some new things. Mm-hmm. Because we're not having that impact where, you know, you get to the end of schooling and only one in five, one in six kids know enough about factorization to be able to apply it to a quadratic expression. I mean, you know, from my point of view, that speaks to why we should definitely be open to just trying some things and seeing if we can't improve on that, because it can't get much worse.
Yeah, and I've been helping my daughter, she's in year 11, and only because she's doing a bit of further maths at the moment is she coming to ask me. She usually doesn't like it. And, you know, she's looking at getting a grade 8-9, but there are so many misconceptions there because everything she's learning is procedural. Well, not every, her approach to it, very much like mine, is to focus on the procedural aspects and finds it difficult then to apply it. Whereas I'm thinking, well, actually, for students who are able to grasp aspects that are more complicated like that, more complex, I need to take her back to using manipulatives and demonstrating to her, look, this is what's happening. This is why it's working. And then that will help her further down the line. But some of the basic mistakes she's making because she's focused on the procedures up until now, I found quite surprising. Sorry, Josh, I came in at the same time as you.
That's right. I was just going to say, as someone who's, I've done quite a bit experimenting with my classes recently with manipulatives, with negatives, algebra tiles, prime factor tiles. Just, I think, exposure to things such as, you know, LaSalle Ed, watching some of their sessions on there and Pete's YouTube channel and coming across MathSpot, which I can't believe we've not quite yet mentioned. But,
yeah, sorry, Johnny.
Well, we'll have him on a screen share very soon, so we'll be here.
Yeah, coming across these things and playing with them and, yeah, trying to have some level of understanding before teaching it. I've definitely changed how I've taught something from one lesson to the next. And I think the point that we made earlier about there being different models things, so subtraction in primary school, it's very much a takeaway model. You're taking away things. And then when you come into negatives, you can do that with a takeaway model, but the sort of idea of the additive inverse and zero pairs I found to be a lot more helpful, not replacing the idea of taking stuff away and making a number smaller, but having another model, another way of thinking. And I think as you sort of progress through that maths journey, you add additional models on, don't you? You gain additional understanding of things. So from counting with things that we know to adding on variables and unknowns in X's, that's a different sort of model, isn't it, to think about? So I've definitely, I think from doing it a few times with, I've only done it with year seven classes with the physical manipulatives recently, but yeah, I'd definitely be saying give it a go
to pick up on both of those things from Josh and Ree, actually, when you look, and you know, you're absolutely right, for something like subtraction, there are different models and they need to be introduced, and the introduction of those needs to be well planned, and that's one of the things we're lacking in terms of the curriculum that's handed down to us from the DfE, is actually some real thought and planning into where those models are introduced and where's the appropriate point to introduce those sorts of models in things like, you know, a difference model of subtraction, the additive inverse idea of subtraction and things like that. But in reality, there are very few concepts and very few models for school at school level maths. You know, what there are some really big concepts that impact in a number of areas and that we see through a number of different lenses, but in effect are all the same structure. You know, proportion is the one I always highlight for that. proportion is a huge idea in school level maths, and proportional thinking is a huge idea in school level maths, and it, you know, it impacts everything from measures and unit conversion and compound units to gradient and the idea of gradient to trigonometry, graphical work, huge amounts in there. But at its heart, it is just proportion. And so if we're, and I say just because, you know, it's a big idea, but when it comes to proportion, there are maybe two or three useful ways of modeling proportion, making sense of proportion, thinking about proportion that are underpinning that. And if pupils learn about those and learn about these ways of thinking about proportion, then what happens is we're not teaching this idea and 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 this idea. What we're teaching is, I'm going to show you another place where the idea of proportion comes into play through the use of, you know, similar shapes, then linked to trigonometry, or through compound measures. You know, what makes speed the same as density, the same as pressure, is the fact that they're all, when you're talking about constant speed or average speed, or, you know, constant density or constant pressure, they are all a proportional relationship between two other variables. You know, with speed, it's distance and time. With density, it's mass and volume. With pressure, it's force and area. And the exchange rate between those, if it's constant, is the constant speed, the constant density, the constant pressure. And so, you know, teaching kids these things as three separate ideas is bound to be problematic, because they aren't actually three separate ideas. And I go further with that. You know, when I talk about this in my classroom, I've been doing this with year 10 at the minute, talk about population density, talk about frequency density with histograms. It's all the same proportional idea. It's about the relationship between these two other things, and that relationship is a proportional relationship. So if we've got good models for this, to the point where pupils can recognize, oh, we're using the, you know, this is the model again. Oh, that's just proportion again then, sir. And, you know, you have kids saying that to you. That's just proportion again. That's just proportion again. Then actually, it's all one big concept. And it doesn't require that same, you know, I come back to it. There's no surprises there then. You know, it's just I'm learning a new aspect of this idea, which I fundamentally already understand.
And that sounds like a really good way for me to say back to you then, okay, so where would be a similar starting point for people who are novices with using manipulatives in their teaching? Is there a fundamental starting point for which we can begin from, and then all other things are sort of branches of or slight adaptations of, to help with confidence? Or is that, is
No, yeah, I get what you mean. And there are, and I would say, representations of number stroke expression. And we have to start recognizing that those are kind of one and the same thing. You know, numbers are expressions. And how do I think about number? How do I make sense of number? I make sense of number in, broadly speaking, two ways. And I've mentioned these before, either as discrete things, like, you know, there are three objects, there are five objects, that sort of thing. Or as a measure, yeah? So this thing has a length of five, this thing has a length, has an area of five, whatever else. And when
would this be a good point for you to show us your screen?
yes, I was going to suggest that as well.
Being subtle.
Christine and Brendan, just any thoughts that you have as well? Or feel free not to, but just...
I was just thinking. There's a lot about manipulatives and how to use them and when to use them, but I think, and I've read a lot on Twitter and places like that. I think equally important is when you start using a manipulative, you have to already know what the exit strategy is going to be. Mm-hmm. How are you going to eventually move away from the manipulative, and you know, get the kids to be able to just think in the abstract, because that's essentially the ultimate goal, isn't it? So considering that that's the ultimate goal, I think that, if anything, that should be given equal weight to how and when to use the manipulative. The idea of when, how do we escape from having to use it all the time? How do we lead the kids to be able to perceive the conceptual? underpinning it.
And I agree with you, Brendan, 100%. And I would say though that question only ever has for me one answer, and that is when comes the point where pupils are so in tune with this structure and have the depth of understanding of this structure that they no longer need to be able to physically manipulate or draw this thing in order to be able to see what is going to happen. When they can see it for themselves in their mind's eye, visualize or in abstract, that's always the point for me where the manipulative is no longer necessary. And for every kid, that's going to be a different point, you know. But so, I mean, talking about, and it comes up, I think, in one of the later questions. In fact, it comes up in one of Josh's questions, using the language of representation and structure rather than a different method. And, you know, recognizing that all of these methods arise from the structure. You know, why do we need to have common denominators when we add fractions? Well, because of the structure of addition, because of how addition works. Yeah. And if I recognize that, then actually I can start looking at that and go, okay, well, at the point where kids are comfortable enough that they recognize about this property of addition, and you know, you could talk about it in terms of unit and the idea that there needs to be a common unit for adding to happen, or you could talk about it in terms of connection, and we might model this in a bit on the math part. This idea of connection, and to represent fractions, I need to define a suitable whole if I'm going to look at them continuously, if I'm going to look at fractions in that way, and that suitable whole will then drive the unit of addition. But at the point where pupils see enough of that, that they recognize that, okay, I know I need the unit the same. I know that I need to think about my whole if I'm going to be adding, if I'm going to be representing both of these things. And I no longer need the cuisenaire rod, the tile, to be able to see how that's going to work. That's when the manipulative makes itself redundant. And that's really the thing, is it's not about us trying to drag kids from using the manipulative to not using the manipulative. What we should be doing is setting up the point to where the manipulative makes itself redundant, because the structure is embedded in our cognition now. We know enough about how this works that we no longer need the manipulative to be able to apply it. Well, Christine, anything you're going to add?
Yeah.
Sorry, no, not really. I was just, I was just thinking about the children that I work with and the fact that, and I think this is something that we touched upon, or at all you mentioned last week with Larissa, that they'll say, you know, I'll bring out the cuisinaire rods, or I'll bring out the base 10 or whatever, and say, oh, have you seen this before? Oh, well, yes, I think we used that when I was in year three. You know, but it's sort of like, oh, well, we're in year five now, so we can't be using that anymore. And it's sort of almost like there's this feeling that once they reach a certain age, they shouldn't be using it anymore. And consequently, it can be stigmatized, you know, the actual use of physical manipulatives. So, but I don't know how you can get around that, really.
Yeah, definitely. And I've seen that, you know, obviously starting in year seven, and we teach year seven mixed ability, and so there are some kids that really are still needing those things in order to make sense of very basic math concepts. And there are some kids that already have that sense. And you know, this comes, I think, into one of the other questions that Joss asked about students who are resistant to using them, both in terms of high attainer and those who see it as not age appropriate. And I think it comes back to what we were saying earlier about it's a shame that these things go away, and the ultimate solution to this is they never go away. Kids see them as an integral part of working with mathematical structure and exploring mathematical structure at all points in their learning. And if they never go away, then there's never a stigma attached to them or anything else. However, what at some point, and again, not being a primary specialist, I don't necessarily know exactly where the best point for this is, but at some point, becoming aware as learners that it's okay to be able to do things without these, and it's okay to go back to them whenever I need to. you know. So and you know, talking to today's question about, you know, higher attainers that might say, I don't need this anymore. Great, fine, you don't need this anymore. You understand enough about this structure that you don't need it anymore. That's fantastic. Crack on, brilliant. Try this and start testing the limits of their understanding. Mm-hmm. And you know, if you test the limits of their understanding enough, you might well push them back to the point where they go, well, I don't know anymore. And then it's like, okay, fine, you don't know anymore. Great, let's bring this tool back that we've used to make sense before. Does this help? Oh no, it doesn't help, because actually that model wasn't particularly useful for this. What about this model that we learned about? Does this help? Oh, actually, yes, this one does help. And this helps me make sense of what's going on now. And that's, you know, that's what math teaching and learning should be about, isn't it, ultimately? Pushing the limits of kids' understanding and stretching the limits of kids' understanding in a continuous way all the way through their journey.
I was going to say, it's your classroom, kind of changing your classroom culture, that it's not a one-tool-fits-all, that it's just we're all completely different, we all learn differently, and whatever you need to use to get to this, we're all getting to the same place, but we're all going to get there different ways, and some of us will need different things. Kind of sort of different, I suppose, really effective differentiation, but also having that climate for learning in your classroom, that it doesn't matter if you're using it and you're not, that's irrelevant. But there's no point in why hobble yourself or hamper yourself if you need to use this. Well, don't worry that Josh over there is not using it, that's fine, but you use it yourself. But I said, kind of getting that culture, and then I think also doing that shift, what we said about manipulatives, is kind of going from, like Rhianna says, well, shifting from that how to the why, which is difficult. And I mentored a UQT this year who I eventually managed to shift from teaching how to actually teaching why really does make a difference, and it does have an impact, and it kind of has, like we said as well, that longer term. Because I'm kind of talking loud, because we're saying about Pete, when you say when you get them to that point where you can, or Josh said, you could fade out manipulatives or Brenda with the exit strategy, but then you've kind of got the whole thing. You've got a test about recall. Do you just still remember this? Can you remember it without the manipulatable, or without that? Because, or should we kind of have it moved for a GCSE? Should this be something at GCSE that we already have exam considerations? Should this be something moved towards GCSE, that a student needs to use a manipulatable or have that there as like a small room concession or a reader? I'm just absolutely spitballing here, sorry.
Yeah,
and I think as they get older, sorry, Pete.
No, go on, Lige, you go, yeah.
Just, thank you. I think as they get older, though, they do fear being judged by their peers. And I think that's part of why they're resistant to bringing back manipulatives or having it introduced, because they think, well, you know, what will others think of me that I can't do it, even though it will actually help them.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this is one of the few places that I do agree with Miss Bowler and others of that ilk. And there's a lot about what she writes that I don't agree with. But one of the things that I do agree with is the sort of cachet that we give to doing without, and quickness and you know, efficiency and completion and things like that, I think is something that we could well revisit in terms of math education across all years, you know, that somebody is seen to be doing better because they can do it in a certain way that others can't at that point. And whether that means better or whether that just means different, I think is something we could definitely do with looking at sort of across the spectrum. In terms of bringing manipulatives into exam halls and things like that, I think that depends ultimately on what you want your exam to test. Yeah, do I want my exam to test the ability to be able to do this purely in the realms of thought and abstract, in which case it's not appropriate? Do I want my exam to test ability to make sense of this in however they need to be able to make sense of this, in which case they are entirely appropriate? And I think, again, you know, in these times about talking about assessment and what's the best way to assess kids, and with the things that's happened in the assessment the last couple of years, that would be a useful thing to feed into to that discussion potentially. You know, what is it we are actually trying to assess of these pupils, and is the way we're currently going about it the best way of doing that? And I say that from a point of view of somebody who believes that exams are the best and fairest way to assess pupils sort of overall. Whether they should be the only vehicle for assessment is more open to discussion, I think, but I think there's definitely a role for them, and probably a majority role for them in terms of assessment. But what they are trying to assess and how they are geared towards assessing that, I think, is perhaps a discussion that we could have, but probably not today, because it would be a very much larger it would take us several hours, I would have thought.
Well, we can move on to the actual screen share, since we can look at some of the basic rudiments that we talked about earlier, like the very basic representations, the number, and the whole journey.
So here we are. We've got MathBot up here, which is obviously the, you know, for me, I know there are others. I'll give a shout out to Mathagon that are doing great work with manipulatives as well at this point. This is still my go-to, which is Johnny's, MathBot.com. And going back to what Ree was saying earlier about, you know, where do I as a teacher wanting to learn more about this start on this journey, for me it would be that bridge from numbers and sort of the manipulative representing the context to that archetypal representation. That representation that will work for numbers in all contexts. And broadly speaking, and as you know, there are always fine details with this, which to get into would require somebody to write a book, for example. But broadly speaking, no laughs on that, come on. Broadly speaking, what we're talking about is two ways of sort of representing number, and what I'm going to try and do is put these up side by side. So we've got a couple of different things here. We've got this one, and here I'm going to turn the labels on. I've got to play with the thing for a minute. There we are. So it doesn't like this when I've done the half. There we go, that's better. So can you see both of those?
Just one.
Okay, in which case I'll stop the share and reshare for both of those. We're going to get a quick sort of, there we are, can you see both of them now?
Yes.
Yeah, good. So broadly speaking, we're talking about two ways of representing number. Yeah, and so we've got an object view, which might be sort of this is 3. And we've got 3 objects here representing 3. And then eventually what we'll move to, and this is, again, another step that learners ideally take in primary school, is this sort of, so they take the step from the object, the manipulative we use actually being representative of the context, to this archetypal unit, but still in this one-to-one relationship. So, you know, one counter here represents one toy, one sweet, one thing, and then eventually to one counter representing multiple things. Yeah, so this now stands for 5. And money's a good sort of practical context there. We're used to £5 notes and things like that, you know, one object representing multiple things. And that has links to multiplication and all sorts of loveliness. And then we have this, which I'm using the algebra tiles, but I could equally use the Cuisenaire, which is we've still got potentially one object, but now what we've also potentially got is a continuous way of seeing this number, that this length is now 3, or even this area is now 3. So this area can now be 6, or this length can now be 6, and things of that nature. And, you know, if I switch that over to the Cuisenaire here, this similar sort of thing, where if this is 1, and some people will go on at me about this one because they say, well, the point of Cuisenaire is not in their numerical representation, it's in their relationships to each other. And they're absolutely right. But if we're going to use them as a model for number, we always need to start in this sort of way by defining what our 1 is. You know, all of our numbers make sense in relation to 1. So what is our 1? If this is our 1, then this is our 2. And this is our 3, and so on and so on and so on. And this is now clearly not 3 separate objects. It is 3 because it is, if in effect, 3 times longer than that, or has an area 3 times greater than that. And when you start with sort of this, then every other concept that's based on number then kind of follows. So then, you know, you come back to here, and I'm going to move my fives out of the way for a minute, but you come back to here and you say, right, okay, so this is, oh, no, I don't want that one, I want this one. So this is 3, and this is 4, and what does adding look like? Well, if I'm viewing numbers in this way, then this is what adding looks like. And, you know, whether you show that to kids explicitly or whether you, you know, whether you're setting up points of inquiry for this doesn't, you know, there are different people that will tell you different things about that and obviously different researches around that. But ultimately, that's less of a concern to me, the pedagogical approach by which you make sure pupils are have this sort of clear understanding of this structure. The pedagogical approach you choose to take to that is sort of the secondary concern. I want the one that's going to work the best and for the most number of people, but I'm probably going to have to use more than one to hit everybody anyway. What I want, my goal, is understanding that when I'm looking at numbers like this, this is what addition looks like. You know, the collecting together, as Atul said before, and I can clump them together like that, or I can clump them together like this, and it's all still addition. Whereas the same addition here is not so much clumping, it's connecting, and I'm connecting these lengths, or I'm connecting these areas, or whatever else. And then everything else kind of just stems from there, really, including things like, you know, order of operations, fractional representation, which is brilliant in this one. You know, introducing fractional representation is not so easy here. And again, this is where it comes to sort of choice of model. You know, what is the best way to think about fractions if I want to think about them as numbers? Well, it probably relates more to here than it does to here. Whereas if I want to think about fractions as the ratio of two integers and this many out of that many, then this might be a better way of looking at them. But everything, you can sort of take yourself on a journey from that starting point. And that's what ultimately, you know, Visible Maths tries to do in terms of taking people or helping people take part of that journey, and ultimately as well what the YouTube channel is hoping to try and do is to sort of take people through part of that journey. And then when you come to things like what was asked before about methods and things like that, so I look at methods like, say, the, you know, the column addition method, and we're looking at, okay, so I might represent, and I should really use place value for this or Dinesh, but it doesn't matter. I might represent the number 32, and then I might represent the number 43 using these objects. But then when I want to come to add them, well, I mean, what does that look like? Well, it looks like the same way it's always looked. I collect together these things. And at some point, we might want to make the thing to, in particular, collecting together the things with the same unit. Okay, but ultimately, it's I collect together these things. So I collect together these things, and then I collect together these things. But ultimately, I've collected them together. I've clumped them together. Yeah, or if you're using Dinesh for that, it's, you know, I'm connecting them together. But this connecting stroke lengthening for purely continuous as well. And for that, the manipulatives, certainly the virtual ones don't really do that very well because they're static in nature. But, you know, things like an elastic band will do that. You know, and this comes back to another question, which I think Suzanne asked about. You know, if you don't have the ICT and you don't have the physical manipulatives, well, you always have the physical manipulatives because everything is a manipulative. Everything is manipulable. You know, so an elastic band can sort of get at the concept of addition in terms of lengthening, in terms of how long is this? Well, it's 5. I stretch it. How long is it now? Well, I've stretched it by an extra 2. Or, you know, subtraction, it was 5, I've stretched it to 7, by how much have I stretched it? Those sorts of things. You can use, you know, pencils and pens for this. Everything is manipulable. Everything that we have in our classrooms can be used to help make sense of these things. And yeah, some of these things are designed specifically to do that job, and so it's great if you have them, and it's a really good idea to sort of be able to use them and be able to support pupils in using them in ways that will help them make sense of these things. But ultimately, you know, anything in the classroom within a thought behind it can help in making sense of these different ideas. And I can't see anybody now, so I don't know if anybody's wanting to speak or anything else, but
it would probably be, you can change it to, there's a setting on the top right where you can put us in a...
Oh yeah. No, I did. I have you now. I didn't have you a minute ago because I need to see both of my windows.
Well, while you were talking, like everything's a manipulative. Something I just thought, based on the multi-base workshop I gave, was that the entire reason we use a base 10 system is because of this manipulative. It's like the entire basis for 1-0 being that, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I often talk, you know, I love bringing in things like that with people. So I talk about how when the Simpsons write numbers, they're probably not meaning the same numbers that we are, because they only have three fingers and a thumb on each hand, and how it doesn't make sense when they write 100 for them to be thinking about the same 100 that I'm thinking of. I love talking about bees when I talk about area, you know, and our area unit being a unit square, and why it makes sense for our area unit to be a unit square for us. But if we were bees, we would probably use a unit hexagon to be our area unit, because bees construct things in very different ways to the way humans construct things and stuff like that. And making those sorts of points is really nice, adds lots of context, but ultimately brings pupils back to, you know, how our world shapes how we make sense of these things, including these abstract things in terms of mathematics. But the beauty and joy of mathematics is that we're not limited to the considerations of our world, and we can stray off into the realms of pure thought and see what the consequences would be, even for those things that we can't actually physically do. That's about the end of it, isn't it? That's like the sign off.
That's a really good one. I mean, any thoughts? I mean, there are questions on Twitter, actually. There's loads. Let me just take one or two. Karina Murg asked very early on, sorry for the basic question, is any type of interactive representation considered a, in quotes, manipulative?
I mean, ideally, it's something that pupils, I mean, you know, the definition, there's no hard and fast definition of manipulative in terms of beyond the dictionary definition being something that you can physically manipulate and change. Yeah. So right now I'm physically manipulating and changing this. So one might consider it a manipulative, and for students to make sense of it, they would need to be able to sort of physically manipulate and change that. Whereas if I put this up on a screen and said, right, now, you know, which I may well very often do, now draw a picture of that to show what's happened. Once we draw that picture, it's much more difficult to sort of manipulate that picture. If I've drawn it in pencil, I might be able to rub it out and redo things, but if I rub it out and redo things, then I've lost what I originally had, etc., etc. So that would be more a sort of visual, pictorial representation of that sort of thing. And then obviously in terms of the abstract, then representing that using a numeral, so using a 3 in a certain place to represent that, followed by a 2, and using a 4 followed by a 3, and then representing the result as a 7 followed by a 5. You know, and creating those abstract numerals to represent those things. But certainly anything for me, and you know, anything that kids can actually get their hands on, can move about, and can sort of make sense of structure by moving things around and playing with things and sort of perhaps well promptedly sort of do things with, you would consider a manipulative. So I mean, I go as far as saying, you know, stuff like upper and lower bounds and calculations of upper and lower bounds, I've taught using pencils and erasers. Yeah, so a pencil is the number, and the eraser is the plus or minus half a unit. So if we're talking about, you know, calculating, say, 0.3 add 0.5, both rounded to one decimal place, well, a smaller pencil is 0.3, slightly longer pencil is 0.5, and the fact that they're not scaled at the point where I'm exploring this with pupils doesn't really matter, because they're happy with the sort of unscaled version of that. If I needed to do the scaled version of it, I'd use it on a number line, or I'd use Cuisenaire or whatever. But that's a 0.3, that's a 0.5. And then I've got my little erasers, which are 0.05 each. And I want to combine them. I've got your two pencils, your two rulers. I want to combine them in such a way that the resulting thing is as long as possible or as short as possible. How do I do that? Yeah, and you can do that with pencils and erasers. You don't need fancy vector arrows or things like that. You can do that with pencils and erasers, perfectly fine. And kids will make sense of that. You know, and kids will make sense of, okay, how do I make the longest thing possible, the shortest thing possible? A bit more difficult with area and with multiplication and division. You can use area for that, and you can use comparative models for division for that with those things. But certainly in terms of addition and subtraction with numbers with bounds, you can use pencils and erasers for that. That's a manipulative. It helps make sense.
You know, paper is a fantastic manipulative. I use that for fractions. The meaning of pi, you just take a little strip of paper. Everyone's got a glass tumbler or something circular at home, so they can wrap that around any circular object, see that there's three diameters, three and a bit diameters to make a circumference. Paper is a great manipulative.
Yeah, absolutely. And you've always got those sorts of things in your classroom.
Yeah. Yeah, and also we are into this really exciting era where there's a virtual form of manipulative. You can do that on MathSpot as well, where you have this tactile touchscreen technology where you're manipulating the picture. That's essentially what you're doing. You can touch it and you can move it. And I've been doing this for, well, nearly 3 years online now with tutees. And there's things like bit paper. You can also stretch. You can actually take a thing and distort and stretch it. You can do that on autograph, etc. They really like playing with it. It's actually closer to kind of this Instagrammy world of filters and pictures and cropping and things. It's all aspect ratios. So we are now in this era of being able to manipulate pictures, picture manipulatives, if you want to call it that, and they work really, really well. I've seen them. Like, you can make multiple copies of things. You can do that. So you got that copy option on MathSpot, where you can just make as many copies as you want. You can copy an array, make multiple copies of the array, and that sort of thing happens much faster in the technology. I know Bernie has loads of different apps that he's always showing. What's that one? Braining Camp. We can do that. Zero pairs. The fantastic thing about virtual zero pairs is they just disappear into nothing, and that's a really great representation of nothingness. That you could merge them, and I've seen them like actually just make the zero pair sound. We talked jokingly about the zero pair sound, so you get three yellows and four reds, and you get zero pair of them out, and one red left over, and so on and so forth. So, gradually there's more and more really good virtual manipulatives coming about as well. You can use them on a mobile phone. Students won't use mobile phone in the classroom, but in their own time they can access the MathSpot site, do the zero pairing, and so on.
Coming back to that journey that I was talking about, and saying, you know, you can go on your own journey with this, starting with the numbers. So somebody had mentioned earlier bar models. I think it was Limes, wasn't it, mentioned bar models for ratio. And, you know, one of the things that I really dislike about the use of bar models for ratio is that people introduce it as a different method. And again, I think Josh talked about this earlier, methods versus representation of structure. So what we should be able to do with a well-planned and well-sequenced curriculum is get to the point where we can say to kids, right, I want to look at this ratio 4:7. Show me 4:7. And here it is. Because they know this is 4 and they know this is 7. And they've worked with these representations of numbers. And then I can say to kids, like, well, imagine this bar, although you said it was 4 bar, imagine this bar was worth 28. What would that be worth? And kids should be used to doing that, because at different points in their journey about learning about numbers, these rods have taken different values. Yeah, this rod was not always worth 4. Sometimes it was worth 8. You know, sometimes it was worth 2. And now I want it to be worth 28. What would this one be worth? And that's not then new mathematics in any real sense. That's just applying things that I already understood about maths, which this is a model for the number 4 and the number 7. But that actually it's not limited to being the number 4 and the number 7. It can be any other thing I decide, depending on how I define my 1, what 1 is. It can be anything else. And then eventually, of course, what we get to is we get to the point where we're saying, right, well, we used to have seen a rod like this taking so many different values. You know, it's been 4, it's been 1, it's been 2, it's been 8, it's been 28. That actually, let's just call it X. Because actually what we're not really interested in is what the value is. What we're interested in is how it works with other things. And that's where the algebra tile takes over as the sort of continuous representation for all number. But it comes from having worked with things like this and having drawn bar models in all sorts of different scenarios, in representing numbers like this and like that from really, really early stages and continuously throughout the journey representing numbers in this way. And then it's just, okay, well, I'm just representing the numbers again. This is nothing new. This is nothing different. This is nothing special. And everything connects and everything fits. And then when it connects, it's when we learn and when we remember. And we, you know, we all know the sort of theories around cognitive load theory and building schemas and connected ideas and stuff like that. These things start to connect. And when they connect, I learn about them. So, yeah. That would be sort of where I would go, be ultimately going with something like this, is kids seeing this enough and seeing this enough that then when I introduce these, or when I introduce these are now just, well, we've seen counters take lots of different values, so let's not focus on the value, let's focus on, if this is a value, what is this? It's double that value. What is this? It's treble that value. And it doesn't really matter what the value is. It's about the relationship between one of those and three of those. Or something like that. And the same way here, you know, if this is a number, what is that? It's 3 times bigger. And it's always been 3 times bigger. It doesn't matter what that number ever was. This has always represented something that was 3 times bigger than the thing I started with. Yeah. And that's the journey that potentially, if you get it all set up right, that kids can go through. But as I'm sure people are appreciating, that's so, has to be so carefully planned and so well sequenced. And this is what I talked about earlier in terms of what's missing from what we have in our curriculum, and when we try and design our own curriculums and things like that, is being able to thread that journey very, very carefully from sort of building on kids' preconceptions about number, because, you know, they meet numbers way before they start school, to all the way through to, you know, however far they're going to go on this journey. What does that journey look like? And what sort of key things do I need to highlight at different points for that journey to make sense? Go on, Limes.
Yeah, going back to what you just said now, there, Pete, about the journey, obviously then we have to take account of the multiple teachers that children will come across, the different parents, everything else. So even if we, you know, with the best will in the world, we do everything perfectly, everybody else they encounter within terms of learning maths will have to have exactly the same approach. So that might cause, you know, misconceptions, confusion. And so, yeah. So it's just making me think about beyond the wider.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm not necessarily, and you know, I have these discussions on Twitter around, I'm not necessarily too worried about potential different approaches, because teachers do need to be able to adapt and innovate for the kids that are in front of them. What I'm more concerned about is, as a collective group of maths teachers, being able to see, right, well, these are the important ways of making sense. These are the important ways of that it's, you know, it's important that kids can see things in this way, can make sense of things in this way. These are the models that are going to help them through multiple areas of maths. And what my job as a maths teacher is supporting that sense making. And that might look different for, and that doesn't mean I'm the guide at the side, you know, and I'm not necessarily saying that either, but that's my goal and that's my job, is supporting them to make sense of things in a way that is going to carry forward, in a way that is going to be useful for whoever picks them up at the next stage, the next teacher, whatever else, can build on that. And that, in that, you know, that teacher is able to be aware of the ways that pupils will have worked with pupils in the past to make sense of things, so that they know what they are able to build upon. And so, you know, all maths teachers being aware of, these are good ways of making sense of these things, these are good ways of you know, being able to model, being able to manipulate, being able to understand these things. Ultimately, these are good structures for these mathematical ideas. These are good models, good metaphors, good structures. These are the structures of these mathematical ideas. And if we had that, along with potentially some good guidance about, you know, where kids might have to be at certain stages in order to be able to comprehend a way of, you know, being able to build on this model, ways of knowing when kids are ready to sort of make the next step with those concepts and things like that, then that journey could look different for every single child, and does look different for every single child, and looks different for, you know, at different points along the primary, secondary, etc. Sort of journey. Not that, and again, you know, Mark will talk about this as well, not that those are separate parts of the journey, they are continuations of the journey. But what I'm not so much of a fan of is people saying, well, you know, you did this method and I prefer this method, so I'm going to teach this method. Because, yeah, okay, great. But if I'm only teaching one method, then what I'm probably not teaching is, what's the structure? Because if I understand the structure, I should be able to make sense of multiple methods. I should be able to see what is happening. I should be able to understand, you know, why. And again, the classic one is the subtraction, the column subtraction versus the equal addition form of subtraction, you know, where, and I'm not sure if people are aware of this, I'm not sure I'd be able to model it here properly, but I'll give it a go.
I think Josh has a question for you.
Give me a second then, Josh. Yeah. In terms of if I want to, well, let's play with it like this. In terms of, if I want to have, and you know, you wouldn't necessarily do this with column subtraction, although some kids might, 32 minus 23. Yeah. And now, if kids were falling back on column subtraction for that, I would think they don't know enough about subtraction anyway. But let's say we were looking at this in column subtraction. So the two methods here that might usefully be employed are column subtraction, and that would result in me exchanging that 10 for 10 of these ones. 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. There we are. So I exchange that 10 for 10 of these ones. And now I'm hoping I've got 10 ones. Somebody tell me if I've done that wrong.
It's all right. Live maths is good fun.
Yeah. So now I can subtract this from that using a takeaway model. So I can take away two tens from here. So you wouldn't actually normally represent this 23 if you were doing column subtraction in this way, but I can take away two tens, I can take away three ones, and what I should be left with is nine ones. Yeah, and that's our standard sort of column subtraction. That's how it works. And then the alternative, or the most common recent alternative. There are lots of alternatives, but the most common recent alternative was the idea of equal addition. So the idea that if I have this 32 and I have this 23, that what I'm going to do is I'm going to add 10 to both of these numbers. But the way I add 10 is going to be slightly different. I'm going to add a 10 as a 10 there, but I'm going to add 10 as 10 ones here. And so I'm going to bring these 10 ones back. So I have added 10 to both of those numbers. And now I'm in a position to look at this and go, okay, well, how much more do I have here than I have here? So I have no more tens, but I have 9 more ones. So the result is 9. Yeah. And what those are doing ultimately are playing on two different models of subtraction. One of them is playing, the first one is playing on a takeaway model of subtraction. And I have to have a certain amount of things to be able to take away those that number of things. And the other one is playing on a difference model of subtraction. You know, I'm looking at what's the difference between these things. And in particular, because these two things are this far apart, if I add the same thing to both of them, the difference remains the same. And if I understand enough about subtraction, I should be able to see that that's what's happening in both of those cases. I should be able to make sense of what how those models are working in both of those cases, that this is looking at difference and take and utilizing the fact that difference remains static through addition. If two numbers are different, then when we add things to them or take away things from them, that the difference remains static. And the first one is working on a takeaway model. And I should be able to make sense of why both of those are telling me something about what 32 subtract 23 is. Yeah. And then, of course, I know Mark would say, well, both of those are flawed. You may as well just do sort of point-wise subtraction and just involve negatives. And then you'd end up with, so if I just did the additive inverse here, which I'm going to attempt to model using normal counters by making these, there we are, by making these red. I can change that color. So now this is negative 10 and this is negative 1, and saying, right, well, if I add those together, and obviously they won't zero pair here, but I've got that, and then those will zero pair. So what I have in is, in effect, 10 minus 1. Yeah, and if I understand enough about subtraction, if I understand different models for subtraction, then I can make sense of all three of those and what all three of those are telling me about 32 subtract 23. Yeah, now I'm not saying we should introduce all of those at once, and I'm not saying that we, you know, that we need to flood kids with all these different models all in one go. That's where we need that thought out sort of journey, and when is it the right place to introduce this model to a point where actually the method is the secondary thing. It's the, you know, whichever one I choose, it kind of depends on how I'm choosing to see those numbers at that time. So Josh had a question, sorry.
Yeah, I was just going to comment about so I think a lot of colleagues and people I've talked to have seen that sort of see manipulatives as being something a bit gimmicky, like just another method to do it. And I think this conversation has helped in seeing the help to see those underlying structures and representation. They're not just another method for some people who don't get the abstract. It's what underpins it. And I think, I'd love more colleagues to try and move beyond the idea of thinking it's just a maths teacher gimmick thing. It doesn't really work. Whereas actually really does, and kids really do see what's actually going on with the numbers for the use of these manipulatives.
Yeah, and I think that was some one of the questions you asked, wasn't it, Josh, about the the idea of teachers seeing these as a gimmick or not, and you know, the start point for that has always been, what's your goal as a maths teacher? And if your goal as a maths teacher is anything other than supporting kids to make sense of mathematical ideas, reevaluate your goal as a maths teacher and then come back to me when you have the correct answer to that question. And at the point where you have at the point where you have the correct answer to that question, and I know, and there will be people who will go nuts on Twitter for this, so I know that there are people out there, and rightly so, who, when kids get to a certain point, their goal as a maths teacher is for them to be able to maximize the cachet that they can get from the qualification. And I know that has to be a consideration. Please do not start atting me on Twitter to say, you know, kids need to be able to pass maths exams and things like that, because I know that. I know that they do. And I, you know, myself, I get you. I said this on, you know, the podcast with Craig Barton years ago. There will always come a point where the practical considerations of our accountability and examination system have to weigh in and ultimately overweigh. Yeah. But that's not the goal of our, so I'll rephrase slightly in that case, that's not the goal of our maths education system. The goal of our maths education system should be kids learning about mathematical concept, mathematical idea. And if that's the goal of our system, then what is the best way to achieve that? And the best way to achieve that is to support students in making sense of good models, good ways of thinking about these mathematical ideas. And yes, there might come a point where we have to turn around and say, well, there, in the time left available to us, you are not going to be able to make full sense of this idea. So I am going to support you in making a limited sense of this idea, which might be just learning a procedure that will allow you to carry out certain calculations or solve certain problems. And that might be that, you know, I'm going to teach you about a very limited part of this concept, knowing that I'm not going to be able to support you to make sense of the full, a fuller understanding of this concept in the time that I have, but that might be enough for you to at least be able to progress and get the things from maths education that you are immediately valuing in the short term. But, you know, be aware of the fact that that is immediately valuing in the short term. It should not be our long-term goal.
Well, it's a very profound place to finish at, I guess. No, it is. I mean, these are the dilemmas we all face. I mean, certainly as a tutor, I know if I have got someone in year 11 and they've just started in year 11 and the grade is the most important thing at that point for them. And so I have to. But at all points, we can be very honest with the students, because it's just like saying, you know, the takeaway model, when they're told at primary it doesn't work. You can just be honest at all points. You can say, like, we're just doing this for you. Brilliant. Well, I'm going to wrap it up there. So, because that's been... Oh, you got any?
I was just going to say, just picking up Lime's questions. You can probably see them on my screen now, but that's fine. Yeah. Just picking up Lime's questions from the end of there, which I don't know if we've tackled fully. I think we tackled this one, which one translates well to students, etc., etc., becoming an accessible tool. In terms of mobiles, I don't know, because I don't use mobiles in my teaching, so I think that's just something to experiment with and get in and have a look at, and get kids to have a look at and see. In terms of the top three representations that will enable students, I think that's what we've sort of talked about here. Ultimately, we're going to want kids seeing numbers in broadly two ways, in a sort of object view and in a sort of continuous view. So having manipulatives that will allow both of those, I think, is important and useful. And whether that's counters and quizenaire, whether that's multi-link and Dinesh, kind of, you know, this or that really, but certainly enough that I can make sense of numbers and the things that are happening to numbers like this, and I can see the numbers and the way things are happening to numbers like this, I think would be what I would be aiming for.
Great. There's so much in that. Just the whole why and how to use manipulatives and the actual technical details. It's a journey. I think no teacher can become an expert at teaching with manipulatives overnight. It's a journey that we all have to go through. We've been through that. So for me, this is just, I love teaching with manipulatives. I love a visual medium. For me, this was just the very beginning. I know for me and Pete are both live streaming, so if both can help it, they'll be manipulatively splattered all over Twitter in these things. I've got another one planned with our primary colleagues who actually asked for a primary manipulatives one, and I have another one planned where we can have a mixture of primary and secondary colleagues. So this is, for me, this is just the beginning, and we can all kind of learn from that. I have a bunch of A-level ones planned as well. So it's really about having these conversations and supporting each other. And to just wrap it up there, if anyone else has any questions, just keep them coming. I know there's lots been coming that we haven't been able to answer. And we will continue talking about manipulatives now that we know this incredible medium of video, live video, virtual manipulatives all work. So for me, this is a fantastic opportunity. Been quite a long time. So thank you everyone for your time and contributing. A few of us I think you're presenting at another talk, Rhiannon. I think yeah. People have to go, so I'm just gonna wrap it up there. I'll end the live stream, and then we'll have a very quick 5-minute chat, and we can debrief and finish there. So thank you everyone on Twitter. I'll just wave a goodbye to everyone so that we know we're finishing.